Access number 11422, Reel 3.
Mostly on cargo boats and tankers and all like that, you see.
Now, so you started on the with the land ports, and then you went on Elder Dempster's down to the west coast.
Yes.
You caught malaria.
Yes.
And then for the summer, did you then go back with land ports, or did you then go?
No, to I went back to the Canard then, and that would bring me up to about the outbreak of war, and I was on a ship called the Antonia. Mm-hmm. Now, the Antonia was nicknamed the ice cream ship by the Liverpool men. Anyway,
right. You said the Antonia was the ice cream boat, you called
it? Yes, the nickname was called the ice cream boat. Yeah. Oh, Antonio was the old song, you know.
Oh, I see, that was the reason.
Yeah, and... Well, each ship had its own nickname with certain, you know, depending upon what they were like. And some of them I can't tell you here, but they were very witty, some of them. But anyway, I was on the Antonia on the sea round from Liverpool to Canada. And I was in Montreal when war was declared.
Right.
And... So we came and in Montreal, the captain told us that war had been declared, and then we had to paint the ship or camouflage as best we can and go to Halifax to pick up our convoy.
Yeah.
Well, of course, the bosun, who was the man responsible for the paint on the ship, he went down into the catacombs of the ship, as it were, and on Earth, paint that had been there for years, and of course they wanted the ship painted grey, but obviously you didn't have all that much grey paint, so they said we'd paint it whatever colour you did have. Well, of course, they gave us different colours and different hues and different degrees of grey and red and blue, and anyway, we just painted because the queenly red and black funnel, it was a really Regency colours of Cunard, the black hull, the white superstructure, and a red and black funnel in those days. They really did look majestic, the ships, you know. And anyway, these queenly colours were all painted out with different hues, and by the time we arrived in the Mersey, I don't think the average person knew what ship we were. We looked like a floating chameleon. But
had you all turned to paint?
Oh yes, yes. Stewards and cooks, bakers, everybody. Because we had no passengers then, you see. Very few passengers.
So you were painting her on the way over, were you, or in port before you left?
Well, in port before we left, but we couldn't, and on the way over. But we couldn't paint the hull, obviously. We covered up the white paint as best we could. But the superstructure and the funnel and masts, well, not the masts so much, but certainly the funnel and superstructure, or only outside. We didn't have enough paint for the inner side of the superstructure. And as I say, we suitably camouflaged the ship until we arrived in the Mersey when she was painted grey. But from the, I left the ship, the Antonia, then, and then I went to, I had my short leave from the Antonia, and I was, went to join the Highland Monarch, which was one of the Royal Mail ships that ran down to Buenos Aires and Rio and all of that. And before I joined the Highland Monarch, they had started gunnery courses then, they didn't have enough services men called up to man the guns, you see. So we merchant seamen had to defend our own ships. It's a thing not much known or appreciated by most people, but the first year or two of the war, we men, which were civilians, we had to handle our own guns, and we were untrained in any way, you see. So we went away on a fortnight's gunnery course, in which we were taught how to fire machine guns and Harlequins and big guns and all that, you know, just a fortnight. And you were, we were sent up to Freshfield, and this fellow used to come over in an old Gloucester Gauntlet, I think it was, a twin wing thing, top speed about 90 miles an hour, towing a windsock behind him. Bravest man I ever knew. And we used to fire at the windsock, you know. That pilot was a very brave man. But anyway, we got the basic trainings of gunnery, and you were given a gunner's ticket, and then you went to, sent down. You never received any extra pay or anything like that. You were just to defend your own ship, self-defence. And I was put on the Isle of Monarch, and she had a 6-inch gun. And me, with my gunner's ticket, I was appointed on this 6-inch gun as the man who shoved in the charge. I think that was number 5 after the shell. And the shell itself weighs 100 pounds of a 6-inch gun. And it was, and those days, all hand loading, you know. Anyway, we sailed, and we were going down off the coast of Brazil when it was reported that there was a warship behind us. So the captain, everybody had binoculars on, and just this thin, grey, distant ship gradually became larger and larger. And we were only capable of about 13 or 14 knots. And the captain tried to get as much ounce, or the chief engineer tried to get as much ounce of speed or power out of his engines, and this ship kept gaining on us. It was the time to graft spay. So captain said, right, everybody stand by your guns, you know. So I said, my God, now there's going to be a chance to be a hero here. And we went to this gun, you know, and we all lined up by the gun. And I'm not saying I wasn't frightened, because I was damn scared. But anyway, when she became a bit more visible to us, then we could see she was a cruiser. And what's more, she was a British cruiser. And it was the Exeter.
Oh.
And as she came up, she flashed over to us. Bet you were scared, eh? So our captain immediately flashed, not with my guns, crew, I'm not frightened of anybody, you see. He didn't ask us. So the Exeter said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll put your boys to test. So our captain said, certainly. So they threw a barrel with a red flag over the side and drifted. And then our captain said, right, we'll fire at this. So we loaded the gun, you know, and we put the charge in. And I'd never heard a 6-inch gun go off before, you know. I'd fired Harlequins, I'd fired twin Harlequins, and I'd fired machine guns, the ordinary types of machine guns, the pan Lewis and strip Lewis. But I'd never fired a 6-inch gun. Well, of course, we lined up the gun and we fired the gun. Well, the noise was like something out of this world. And when a 6-inch gun fires, a huge tongue of red flame comes out of the barrel, you know, which is blinding. And all the black bits and pieces of the explosive charge blew in our faces, and the noise left you deaf. Anyway, after the first shot, we were going to fire 3 shots, you see. Well, the second and third weren't too bad then, after, because you knew what to expect. And anyway, the Exeter then flashed back to us, very good shooting, very good shooting. They were all just round the target, because really you don't hit a target to be right at sea, not like a gun, a handgun or a rifle. You've only got to go near the target to do the most damage, you see. So the Exeter said, excellent shooting, excellent shooting. Splice the main brace, which was telling the captain, so we all got a tot of rum out of it. And we only had a few passengers on, and they all collected, and we got the large amount of 30 bob each, which was fine. So the captain was that pleased that he got us all in his room, and they gave us our rum. And he said, now look, boys, he said, I can't pay you, give you any money for your gunner's ticket, anything like that. I'm forbidden. He said, I can't do it at all. But he said, what I can do is, I'll say that you had half an hour's gun practice every day, and I'll give you half an hour's overtime, which was a shilling, which wasn't bad. So we got a bob a day for that. And he said, "I've only given you this because you're good, because you have your good, you know, also good because you're a good shot." So we're quite proud of that. So anyway, we went down to Buenos Aires, and we managed to get in Buenos Aires before the Buenos Aires,
Monte,
Rio, and before this battle outside, and we managed to get in safe. And then the battle took place after we left Brazil and went down to Buenos Aires then. And coming back up, we could see the smoking ruins of the Graf's Bay when it happened, you know. So really, if she'd have got hold of us, we could have really...
Oh, yes.
Oh, aye. Anyway, we went back, got back home safely to join our... Got picked up our convoy, went back home, hoping that we wouldn't have to fire that six-inch gun again. Because, as I say, like everybody else, I'm not exactly a hero. So I left the Highland Monarch, then I joined a banana boat called the Patea, which ran through the Mediterranean to Haifa. And they were short of sailors on deck at the time. And I had also gone in for my... they were short of sailors, so I went in for my efficient deckhand ticket, which is a sort of a secondary to an able seaman. Between... a sailor and an able seaman, this efficient deckhand. You were trained in, as everything, steering and knots, ropes, everything. So I did a trip on her as a sailor, which was a little bit more than a steward. Not much, but a little bit more. And I left her when she came back, and then I joined the famous Reina del Pacifico. That's that.
Oh, yes.
And now, she, Reina del Pacifico, was a famous Liverpool ship running down to Valparaiso through the Panama Canal for oceans about 1933 or 34. She was a fast ship. She could do about 19, 20 knots. And she was a fairly modern ship, as ships go. She was only about 6 years old when war broke out, 5 or 6 years old, you see. But she was then a transport. And we ran troops round to Suez. And back home, by the Cape. We couldn't go through the Mediterranean at that time because Italy had entered the war. Then I did, I joined the Reina Del in April in 1940, and I left her in February 41. I was on her well over 12 months. And then I joined the Georgic. I did a couple of runs to Halifax, where we picked up Canadian RAF men to bring over to England, as well as a few nondescript passengers. And then we went to Suez, the usual way, down round the Cape to Cape Town and up the east coast of Africa to Port Chufik, where we unloaded them. On the 14th of July, we were anchored there, and we got in about the 12th of July. On the night of the 13th, 14th, anyway, I can't remember the exact day, a couple of barges came alongside with scrap iron that we were going to load to take back to England. So we started loading this scrap iron. And we were loading. They started to load about 8 o'clock at night, and we were still loading at 11 and 12. They were going to work all night, the Arabs, in these barges alongside us. We were anchored out and taking the scrap iron on when the air raid sirens sounded ashore. So the skipper immediately got on the radio to the shore people and said, "Well, I'm loading scrap iron here with floodlights on." We put them out, and so the senior naval gentleman ashore, just shows you the brains of the senior naval gentleman, they said, "Oh no, leave your lights on, you're quite all right, continue loading the scrap iron, that's very important, and there'll only be Italian planes anyway, and you're all right." So we went on loading with the floodlights. Well, of course, the planes turned out to be German, I believe, and they came over, and we were the only plane with the lights, we were the only ship with the lights on, and they just bombed us and set us on fire, and we were a blazing mass within about 5 or 6 minutes. So it just shows you that sometimes the senior Navy men ashore have not got all the brains, because they lost a damn good 33,000 20-knot ship capable of carrying thousands and thousands of servicemen. They lost it for the sake of a few tons of scrap iron. I don't think that's a very good swap. Anyway, I was lucky that when she was blazing, there were lots of little boats came from the shore, and Arab dhows and all this came alongside, and I dived over the wall and was picked up by one of the Arab dhows, who brought me and several others back to Tewfik, where we were put in a military camp, and to await transport home. So anyway, we came home, and passing through Durban and Cape Town, where we were looked upon as heroes, if you know what I mean, survivors of the Georgic. And those people are intensely patriotic, those South Africans, you know, especially in Port Elizabeth and the Durban, which was where the English troops originally invaded South Africa to take it from the Dutch in 1900, as you and I know. We're the right one to talk, aren't we, England? Anyway, they were very, very kind and very patriotic, and they did an awful lot of the regiments in the Western Desert. Did an awful lot of fighting, you know, the South African regiments, fine regiments. But having said that, we came home, and then I had my leave, and I did a trip then on the Gascony, which was a cargo boat, to South America. The Gascony was another Royal Mail cargo boat. That was an eventful, small ship, in which we brought 10,000 tons of sugar back. If a torpedo had hit us, at least it would have been able to assimilate a lot of the power of the torpedoes. But fortunately, we got home. And then after my leave, was sent to join the Gloucester Castle. Well, the Gloucester Castle was a very old ship. She was about 36, 37 years old then. Okay. A coal burn, yeah, fairly ancient. And she sailed from Birkenhead on the... the 2nd of July, 2nd of June, bound for South Africa. And when we got near Freetown in West Africa, the convoy broke up there, and the ship's captains were asked if they wanted to stay in Freetown while another convoy was formed up to take us right down the Cape, or we could go on our own individually. Well, the captain of the vessel reasoned, the Captain Rose, he reasoned that we were outside U-boat area, yeah, and we were fairly safe. Uh-huh. So he elected to carry on. We had enough coal, she was a coal burner, had enough coal to take us to Cape Town. So the convoy commander said, oh, we're all right then, if you want to, go on your own. So we carried on our own. Well, we steamed down these tranquil waters off West Africa, very hot, humid, but nice sailing. When, at 6 p.m. on the 15th of July, the whole world opened up in a... fire of machine guns, shells, everything being pumped into us. The noise, the smell of burning cordite, it was all, and we were wondering what the hell was the matter. Where was it coming from? We were also carrying 40-gallon drums of aeroplane dope on deck, stacked outside the crew's entrance to their accommodation down below, incidentally. Shows you the wisdom of that. Now, that aeroplane dope immediately caught on fire. I happened to be down below when all this firing was going on, and we thought somehow that the ammunition locker had caught fire in some way. And that was the ammunition going off of the ship aft, you know, our gun. We had a single 4.7 gun. Anyway, I was down below with about 12 other men, and we got to the bottom of the stairway, and we gazed at this red shape of fire, which was our doorway at the top of the companionway. What it was the dope had spilled on the deck and was caught fire, and that was flaming up, you see. So we were down there, and Perrin, one or two of the lads there, they said, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? I said, well, I said, if we're going to stay down here, we're going to roast. And my idea was to go up the stairs, through the fire, and over the side then, and tread water until you can grab a piece of wreckage, you see. So, and now I'm no hero. I was probably more frightened than the rest, and fear drove me up that stairs. And when I got up on top and stepped out the doorway, I found that the flames weren't quite as high as what I thought they were, and it was all emanating from the floor itself and swirling about as the ship was beginning to list then. So I ran down along an alleyway, and a few of the lads all came up behind me. And those who stayed down below, well, they just didn't get out. Well, I managed to get up to my lifeboat. But when I got...
Did you get through the flame? You just sort of dived through it?
Yeah. And by then, I got to an area where there were no flames then. It was only just round the... just outside this door leading out onto the old deck. Mm-hmm. And that was where the flames were, fortunately. Otherwise, if they'd have been all over the deck, well, I suppose the heat and the fumes of the... toxic fumes would have, you know, and that's why I didn't go right over the side. If the flames had been all over the deck, I might add, you I'd have gone right over the side. Yeah. Because from the door that leading out on deck to the side would have been only about...
10 feet?
Well, maybe 15 feet, you see. But when I got up, the flames weren't as bad. So when I, anyway, threaded my way through the... flames, and then got in the accommodation, and then I noticed that the saloon deck then was, there was water in the accommodation then, and I couldn't understand this. I didn't realise that the old ship was slowly sinking. I couldn't, how the hell's the bloody water come to be in the saloon deck? So
hadn't any alarms been sounded?
Oh, the alarms were sounded then, yes, all right. And our lights, we just sort of turned them upside down, which activated them into the light going on, you know, the batteries then. And there was a bit of confusion amongst the inner accommodation. We only had about 12 passengers on board. And we were an empty ship, passenger-wise. But we would have had a lot to bring up from South Africa, you know. Anyway, I makes my way up on deck. When I gets up on deck, there was a smell of smoke and burning, and there were no lifeboats. They were all shattered. There was just bits of wood there. And there was only one lifeboat, and we managed to break the two strops underneath, and we lowered it down to the water with a fellow named Dave Jones, a Glaswegian, and his leg was broken, but we sort of threw him into the boat, broken leg and all. And there was just the ladder going down then, the rope ladder leading down to the boat. And there was only about three or four of us on deck, and there was two old ladies there as well, you see. And then this silence that always occurs after a battle. It was complete silence, except for the crackling of smoke and bits of wood and that, you know, but it was a certain amount of silence. And I realised that these two old ladies, one was an older stewardess and the other was an older passenger. And I realised that they couldn't get down that rope ladder. And the ship was sinking then, you know, and water was beginning to swirl around our ankles then. And the old lady turned to me and she said, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And I just couldn't answer. I was amazed at everything. And the older stewardess, it will always remain in my memory, this till the day I die. The older stewardess put her arm round the very old lady, and she said, come with me back to my cabin and we will talk to God. And I watched those two old ladies going down that slanting deck, which was now listing, and they stepped through the outer combing into the passenger accommodation. I never ever saw them again. Then what happened then was, I said, that's funny, why is the sea coming over the boat deck? why is the sea coming over the boat? And then it dawned on me that the ship was sinking. And I said, my God. And on the mast, all the bits and pieces floating, that would begin to float around my ankles. Mm. I had my life jacket on, by the way, I forgot to tell you. It was the old cork life jacket, two big pieces of cork on the front and back, very old fashioned. Suddenly knocked my knee, and I looked down, and there was an empty life jacket. So I picked it up. I said, well, if I might meet some bugger, I said, who has got a life jacket on? Because don't forget, I had a little bit of a previous experience in ships sinking. Mm. And I might meet some bugger who hasn't got a life jacket. Just then, the old ship went down, with me standing on the deck, holding this life jacket. Now, I was caught in the vortex of the old ship going down. It was a maelstrom. There was wires beating me in the face, bits hitting me, and I went down, 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 and I am a fairly good swimmer, you know, and I held my breath, and when you're dying, you know, you don't think of God. You don't think of heaven and St. Peter and to do your hell. You think of your mum. You think of your dad. You think of the street in which you were born. And you think, my God, I wonder if Mrs. Green will ever get to know this. If Mrs. Green, a neighbour. Or, blimey, that little old street with that cinema at the bottom, the Derby Cinema. Wasn't a bad cinema, that. And you think of your sisters and your brothers saying, wonder what would happen with all us being in this predicament. These are the things you think of. And I was dying. And, well, I was near death. I've been near, went through near death many, many times during the war, but that was the nearest. Mm. And then a funny thing happened. I went down that much, I couldn't hold my lungs any longer. And as I say, I am a good underwater swimmer, even at that time, because I was only young, 22. And I sort of breathed in seawater through my mouth and nose. And it seemed, funnily enough, to ease this terrific pain on my chest. And then all of a sudden I noticed that the blackness of my eyes were beginning to go grey. And I realised then that that is daylight and I must be coming up to the surface. And that gave me an added incentive to hold onto my breath longer. And it went lighter and lighter and lighter. And then I felt a cool air on my wet face. And I gazed up and it was just the moon. Nothing else. Moon down on me. And I thought, this isn't happening to me. I'm going to wake up. This is a nasty dream. This is not true. I'm going to wake up. But alas, it was true. And I then heard somebody say, hey, hey. And I'd come up near this shattered lifeboat, and which Davy Jones we'd thrown in was the only, and he was still there with his broken leg in this shattered lifeboat that had somehow become washed away from the vortex. So he helped me in with his broken leg and all, and I got in and I vomited up all this oil and seawater in the bottom of the boat. And then we proceeded to, your life jacket had little red lights on then, and people were going, help, help. And we had no oars or anything, and the boat was smashed, but we sort of managed to pull a few other people in, and seamen, other seamen sort of splashed their way towards us. Mm. And then I became aware, I didn't see, I became aware of a huge grey shape. And the lads in the ship became aware as well, in the boat became aware. And somebody said, it's a ship. So we thought, oh, good, it's a ship, it's a ship, it's a ship, it's a ship. So we started shouting, hi, hi, hi. So somebody said, get a light, get a light. But nobody had a bloody light. But we're waving, started waving then and shouting, hi, hi. So then we heard a voice shout down, not with an English accent, foreign accent, saying, stay where you are, stay where you are. And we couldn't bloody move anyway. And gradually this ship, this huge, what turned out to be a German raider, was coming alongside the lifeboat. Wonderful feat of seamanship. Mind you, it was a calm sea. And then sailors slid down ropes and bounced into the lifeboat, and they were wearing a Kriegsmarine uniform. We are German seamen. And there can't be a U-boat. It was this raider. Well, when we told them that we were on a British passenger ship and that there was women and children on board, I must give my honour to these Germans. They threw off their jackets into the shattered lifeboat and dived underneath broken lifeboats, pulling bodies out to see if they could help them in any way.
Did they?
Oh, yes, they did. And we managed to get two women and two kiddies, one a boy about 14 and one boy about 10. And by that time, the other men had sort of secured the lifeboat alongside the lines to the rope ladder coming down from this radar. And we were searchlights were then shining on us then all over the show, you know.